from when I was a child. What I wanted was to be a gentleman. Life just crept up on me. One day preceding the next. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Williams.
Not happy, not unhappy. A small wonder I didn't notice.
Mr. Williams, doctor will see you now.
The results have come back. It's never easy, this.
Quiet.
But he's never late. Something must have happened.
Mr. Williams, it is you.
I was thinking lunch at Fortnum's.
Fortnum's?
Why not?
Mr. Williams, I'll tell you my secret nickname for you. Mr. Zombie.
Mr. what?
Zombies are sort of dead, but not dead.
Hello, and welcome to the Movie Robcast. I'm your host, Rob Wallace, and as always, it's a delight to be joined by my co-host, Mr. Rob Daniel.
And as always, it is a complete delight to be here.
And today, we're going to be talking about Living, the remake of Ikaru, that is now arriving in cinemas, or I believe it has now arrived.
Yeah, we're recording this on Sunday the 6th, and it arrived on Friday the 4th of November. Out now to watch, so as soon as you've listened to this, you should speed out and watch it, which kind of gives away what I think of this movie. Just before we move on, quick bit of housekeeping. I think that my neighbours, we're actually recording this quite early on a Sunday morning, but my neighbours are also up early, so you might hear a little bit of background noise because they are moving around upstairs. Either that or there is a killer doll that took them during the night and now is just running around. It's one of the two.
It's a week since Halloween. I wouldn't worry about it.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah, so that would have been... They're probably safe then. Probably safe. Annabella's gone back into her glass box.
Yes. Well, yes, because we both saw a Living at the London Film Festival a number of weeks ago now, with the relentless march of time. And yeah, Rob, would you like to read the synopsis as it appears on IMDb?
I shall.
Actually,
indeed.
Don't read that because it's rubbish.
Well, let's give it a look. An English language adaptation of the script of Ikaru, 1952, set in London in the 1950s. Yeah, that's kind of what Rob said. So let's give our own little bit of a synopsis about this. So I would say in London, just after the war, a Mr. Williams, played by Bill Nighy, who is a button-down city council planning manager, discovers that he's dying of cancer. With less than a year to live, he decides to do one last meaningful thing. And we're not going to spoil what he decides to do, because it's actually a lovely reveal. And anyone who's seen Ikaru, the Kurosawa Akira film from the 50s will know what it is. But I think lots of people haven't seen that, so we're not going to spoil what is the one last wonderful thing that he decides to do. Yeah, as Rob said, we saw this at 8:30 a few Sundays ago. I love Ikaru. I think it's possibly one of the 10 best films of all time. And I actually didn't know there was going to be a remake until Rob was telling me which films he was most looking forward to at this year's London Film Festival. And I was very, very surprised to hear that Bill Nighy was appearing in a remake of Ikaru set in London. And I just didn't think that that boded well. It is fantastic, and it's fantastic for a number of reasons. One, it keeps the period setting. So Ikaru was made just after the war in the bombed out ruins of Tokyo. And this is actually set in the 1950s as well, which is absolutely crucial to the story that's being told. It just wouldn't work today, I don't think. Much like Tokyo, after the war, and for decades after the war, London and other UK cities also had bombed out ruins that just weren't being developed on. So there are some really, really interesting comparisons and parallels between the two films. And you just wouldn't think that Ikaru would relocate well, but I think it does it beautifully.
And I do think that is largely due to Ishiguro Kazuo, because obviously he does have some form in dramatising mid-20th century British repression.
Yeah, that's right. So the other key reason why this works so well is, as Rob said, Ishiguro Kazuo is the writer of this. I think he's also one of the co-producers. He's best known as the author for The Remains of the Day, which is just a fantastic look at English repression and also the passion that always kind of simmers beneath the surface. It's also a great look at the class system. So a lot of that is lifted and shifted into Living. And yeah, just works absolutely fantastically here as well. I think he lives in England, doesn't he? And he does understand that there are some similarities between the British mindset and the Japanese mindset, including politeness and a rigid social structure that is beginning to loosen. But the fact that we still have a royal family shows that there is a rigid social structure. We still have dukes and earls and things like that. The class system is alive and well in this country and also in Japan as well. I mean, interestingly, Kurosawa came from a samurai family, and the samurai were a class in Japan. You were born into a samurai class. You couldn't be a peasant and work your way up to being a samurai. It was a very, very rigid social structure historically in Japan. So if you were born a farmer, then you were a farmer for life. If you were born samurai, then that's what you would do. So Ikaru comes out of that. And yeah, there are parallels with British history there as well.
And I think the film is very... I mean, the film's not to the same degree about the class system, because most of the characters are middle class. But there is a real lightness of touch in terms of how it manages to capture. How do you show emotion without showing emotion? You know, how do you imply the kind of depths of feeling that exist within these characters that they are unable to express? Because, you know, I love Bill Nye usually. It's quite against type, because you think Bill Nye and you think twinkly, you think the sparkle in the eye, you think that glint of mischievousness.
Yeah.
But here he's kind of had to, I mean, Williams is, I think the way I describe him in my review is, he looks like a man who's trying to swallow his own voice.
Yeah, it's a great way to put it. He is a living statue, isn't he? To be honest, sometimes with Bill Nighy, I think he can sometimes do, in a weird way, a bit of a Nicolas Cage, in that he has a set of tropes and tics that we all know and love, and he'll fall back on those. I think this might be his best performance, because this is a proper character, and he doesn't really rely on any of the things that he normally does to bring an audience in to a character that he's playing. It's completely, as you said, it's completely buttoned down. I mean, he is literally immaculately tailored in this film, but utterly buttoned down. He has like three sets of buttons on his suit, his waistcoat, and his shirt. He's all buttons. But within that, you get the torment and the joy of someone who realizes that they're going to die soon and knows that they can do something and that they have to do something before they die. And so you get that torment, but also the exhilaration that he starts feeling as well. It will be interesting to see, because I think that plays really, really well to British audiences who understand that you don't want to bother anyone with your problems, so therefore you'll just keep it all in. Be interesting to see go on.
The first thing he says when he learns about, you know, his impending death, as he just basically refers to it, it's a bit of a bore, really.
Yes, that's right. Because he spent his whole life in bureaucracy, and everything is ordered. So when something is out of order, then it becomes a bit of a problem and it just becomes a hassle for everyone. And so therefore this thing that's happened, which is not supposed to have happened to him, becomes a bit of a hassle and he doesn't want to bother anyone with it, which comes across really well. But I'd be interested to see how it plays in other countries like America or Italy, where it's like,
why isn't he telling them?
Why isn't he just saying what he thinks? Because that's impossible. It is impossible for him to do that. And that's where the emotion comes from, I think, for me, in this film. And it's also one of those things where the supporting cast, I think, all breathe real life into their characters. So you have Amy Lou Wood from Sex Education. I've not watched that, but I hear that it's very, very good, and I should. So she is Miss Harris, this young woman in the office who Williams kind of begins to enjoy her love of life when he finds out what's happening to him. The arc and flow of their relationship I thought was absolutely fantastic. Yeah, and Adrian Rawlins, who plays like the deputy in the office, he just has one of those great faces.
he's so good at playing, I guess, sort of like peevish.
Yes.
It's like he's not annoyed, but you get the feeling that he could very easily be annoyed.
He's someone who thinks that life is going to be annoying at any moment.
And in all fairness, he's not wrong.
Yeah, there is that, absolutely. He has like one of those good old faces as well, which is why it's no surprise to find out that he was, I think he recently guested in All Creatures Great and Small. He's also in Gentleman Jack. Yeah, he fits a period setting very well. What do you think of the supporting cast, though?
For a film that is about Bill Nye's character, about Williams, it opens with him being talked about, the film. And it actually takes you a little while until you see him. And he's kind of built up to be this figure who is actually quite imposing. And you've got, almost as the audience surrogate, at least initially, you've got Alex Sharp as Mr. Wakeling, who's only just joined the kind of the public's works department. It's a film, I really like it, you know, obviously in much the same way that Icaro was. It's this exploration of bureaucracy, of this group of people who sole job is to essentially push papers around and not change anything.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, is another little bit of nice commentary about Britain. And the fact that it takes something really quite devastating, quite radical to instigate change. And you've also got, you know, you've got Williams's family, you've got his son, Michael, and his son's wife, Fiona, and like neither of them really want him around. Fiona kind of really does actually want him out of the house because he's clearly a bit of a, you can imagine, you know, he's a bit of a spectre at the feast.
Yes, indeed.
And Michael's not going to defend him because Michael's very noncommittal. Michael's just kind of like, he's not going to defend or attack him. And actually, in that way, you can almost see that that's actually, you can kind of say Michael following the same track that he followed.
I was going to say, he is his father's son, that's right. Yeah, so Michael played by Barney Fishwick, that's right. And who plays his wife again?
Patsy Ferrin.
Patsy Ferrin, yeah, she's very good too. And it's one of those where it's like, they are, I suppose, kind of, well, they're not portrayed as villains, but they're portrayed as people who are unthinking. One of the things I liked about this is that there's aren't any real villains here. There's just this huge monolithic bureaucracy that this guy suddenly realizes that he just has to navigate, and he has to use his tools, his a special set of skills to navigate this, one of which is politeness.
Wait, did you just somehow indirectly compare Living to Taken?
I did, and I did that very, very consciously, because this is an exhilarating film, and it's a drama. It's a period drama, and it's a film that looks like an old film. I mean, the opening credits look like a 1950s.
It's gorgeous, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it made me think of Carol.
Yes, indeed. It does have that kind of old look to it. Yeah, so Carol looked like 16mm photoplay shoots and the covers of photoplay and stuff like that. This looks like Eastman colour. This is one of those films where it's like, I don't think there's a lot of green in it. It's very, very red and blue. So it's kind of earth colours and blue that looks like old film stock. And then when it goes into the actual film, it kind of isn't quite as striking as it is in the opening credits, which I thought was going to be a problem at first. But then you suddenly realise, actually have kept that old film look. And it does look like an older movie. It's also shot in 4:3, so that square, which suits it really, really well. But the reason why I did compare it to Seven is because this is an exciting
Seven.
And... Seven. The other one, Taken.
Taken.
It's not Seven.
It's not, Jesus. When Williams finds out that he's dying, he sees people around him not appreciating life. No, wait a second, that's Saw.
That's right. You see, there are so many things in this film.
Do you want to play a game?
Saw, and then Seven, and then Living to take the edge off, yeah. But it is exciting. It's an exhilarating film. The same way that Icaro is exciting and it is exhilarating, even though it is a contemporary drama from a guy who's most famous for epic samurai movies. That's another thing that the two have in common. So yeah, so he has to use a special set of skills to navigate this, to achieve what he wants to do. And one of them is politeness, which he kind of turns into a superpower. This film understands Englishness, just the way that people speak in this film. And sometimes the politeness can be absolutely sincere, and other times it can be passive-aggressive and like a weapon.
I don't know what you mean.
Yeah. And yeah, just that very, very Englishness. Also, the other thing that's very, very English about it, but also kind of Japanese as well, is that he has trouble telling those nearest and dearest, well, those nearest to him, what's happening, but he'll blurt it out to a complete stranger. if someone's not immediately involved with you, then you can tell them this, and it's almost like it's not as much of an imposition because they're not part of your circle.
Yeah, and so because it's also got, there's a scene where he goes out in the town, which again is from Ikiru,
yeah,
with a character played by an absolute stranger to him, this kind of larger-than-life bohemian figure played by Tom Burke.
Who's great.
Is wonderfully well. I mean, he's played Orson Welles. I think he was on Orson Welles in Me and Orson. No, it wasn't Me and Orson. Which one was it? But he does have that tremendous kind of physical presence to him.
He really does.
Oh, yeah, sorry, no, that's what he was in. He was Welles in Mank.
Oh, right, okay. Wow, I do not remember him. But you've just reminded me of something there, and thank you very much. On the London Film Festival podcast, I said that we got locked in that churchyard whilst talking about Mank in 2019. It was, of course, 2020, because we were in a brief period of being allowed outside. So it was actually within COVID that we got locked in the churchyard.
Yeah, there's a certain degree of irony attached to that. It's like, you're being led outside because at this point we don't think that's a risk to anyone. You know, we don't think there's an immediate risk to life. Now you're being locked in a churchyard. You're being locked in a graveyard.
Wasn't it? It was like, oh, the irony is so thick. Sorry, I interrupted you there. Mr. Burke, we thought he was good.
Yeah, he's a really interesting presence in any film that he's in. I've really enjoyed Living, and it's one that actually I'm going to enjoy showing my parents because I know they. I'd be surprised if they'd seen Ikiru. I think is there BBC money involved? There's
Film 4
money involved. So it'll be Film 4 and BFI money involved. So it'll make its way onto the public service broadcasters at some point, if All 4 is a public service broadcaster at that point.
Well, I read that Rishi Sunak is apparently planning to shelve the plans to privatise Channel 4, which is a rare good thing that he's considering. So, yes, hopefully that will stay a public company. But you're right, it is going to come to telly pretty soon, I think. I would strongly recommend that people go to the cinema to see it, because even though it is shot in 4:3, it is a gorgeous-looking film. I mean, it looked fantastic on that big Odeon screen, didn't it, in Leicester Square?
Yeah, it's a film, but, you know, it's quite self-contained. I mean, but it does have a sweep to it. Mm. I mean, on which note, you know, Oliver Hermanus, who directed it.
Who's a South African director, isn't he?
Yeah, and it's just a beautifully composed film.
And I have to admit, I hadn't heard of him, and I don't think I've seen any of the other films he's done. So he's done things like Moffy and Beauty, Shirley Adams. To be completely honest, I've not heard of any of these movies. So he's a director. Shirley Adams was 2009. He seems to direct a film every 3-ish years. And this is his 5th film. Might have to check out another one of his movies because, well, this is going to be in my top 10 of the year. The question is, how high up is it going to be? But in terms of what you said about the class system, I think the class system is still a massive thing in this. Not in terms of that there are lots of different classes represented, but just in terms of it presents a time and a country where everyone knew their place. And there is a representative of the upper class in this film.
Yes.
Who is in a pivotal scene. And that kind of thing where it's like, yes, we are only seeing really one class. I mean, there are some working class people in this who come to the office because they want to have something changed. And they get passed from one person to another. But this isn't a film I think that would work today because it's like, well, why is everyone being so deferential? Why is no one saying what they think? So I think the class is a huge thing in this. And even though obviously it's not the same now, it's still very, very recognisable to us, I think, or at least to me, because I'm a bit older than you.
Yeah, obviously, by the time I was growing up, we'd got rid of the class system.
Yeah, that's right. It's just a meritocracy now, this utopia that we all live in.
Wait, no, apparently that's not true. Okay. Breaking news.
Oh, actually, there was one other thing, and I completely forgot to say after we'd seen the film, it only came back to me a few days afterwards, that I can't remember who I was meeting, but I was walking down Piccadilly one night, or one evening. This was a few months ago, just after I'd moved back to London. So it was about 6 in the evening, but it was light and sunny. Bill Nighy came out of a building, dressed in the blue suit that he wears in Living. And he was with, I assumed, like a producer or someone, because this guy looked like a producer. He was, you know, late middle age, but in a t-shirt and jeans and, you know, the burnt in stubble of someone who doesn't always have to look like, you know, their best. They just looked like that British producer type. And they got into this car that was waiting for them. And it was like, wow, Is that just how you dress, Bill Nighy? You just dress like that because you have the frame for immaculate tailoring. Now I realise they were probably having a photo shoot or something in that building for Living. Because it's like, oh yeah, you were actually dressed up as your character.
Yeah, you do get the impression that Bill Nighy is very refined in real life.
Yeah, yeah, and he does look it, doesn't he? And it's also one of those things that when you see him in real life, there's just no doubt that it's him. I mean, he's kind of the size you think. I think it's about 5'10". And as soon as I saw him, it was like, that's Bill Nighy. That's obviously him. And he's about 8 feet away and he's getting into that car. And I can't stop looking at him because, wow, he looks amazing in that suit. That's Bill Nighy with a slubby producer, I presume. But it's like, oh, look at that.
I would like Bill Nighy to get an Oscar nomination for this.
Once again, you just read my thoughts. I was going to say, obviously this is going to get some BAFTA noms, but yeah, do you think that it could be up for Oscar noms?
I hope so. I mean, it might be a bit small, but, you know, and I don't know, maybe the Oscars aren't enamoured with people having, you know, deep unexpressed feelings. You know, maybe things have shifted. I mean, you know, I don't, as I often say, I don't go to bed worried about Bill Nighy's Oscar chances. I think he's probably doing all right, you know, on his own terms. But it'd be good. I think it'd be a nice bit of recommendation. One of our best actors.
Yeah, indeed. I think that he should get an Oscar nomination. But then again, it's like, yeah, there are many, many films you see in the year where it's like, well, if that doesn't get Oscar nominated, then what are they looking for? But this one is like, well, it seems, you know, film four has an Oscar pedigree in terms of other films that have been recognised before.
I'm just thinking, like, you know, who else is going to be... I mean, probably Brendan Fraser for The Whale.
Yeah.
And maybe, if it's going to be one of the... Colin Farrell for Banshees of Inisherin.
Well, that's interesting, because you've seen that I haven't. So you would say that he would be up for actor more than Brendan Gleeson.
Yeah, Brendan Gleeson's in the more of a supporting role.
Ah, interesting, okay.
Elvis is Austin Butler.
Yes.
Those are kind of the main ones that, I mean, we haven't seen everything yet, but...
No, I agree. I think those would all be in with a shout. And I think if Mr. Nighy isn't in there, then that would be a shame because he does give a fantastic performance in this film. He's just so good. So I'm trying to think, is there anything else to say about Living? I've told my mum that she has to see it. So she tends to go to the cinema every Sunday with her friend Linda. Hello, Mum and Linda.
So she might be seeing it today.
She could be, yeah. But the thing is, the Odeon where they are, they tend to show this sort of film really, really late. So it just ends too late. And it's like, oh, come on, guys, you have to... It can't all be fucking Black Adam. It's like, you have to give these films a bit of a chance. You need to put them on, particularly on a Sunday, 7 in the evening, right? I mean, it's a perfect time for this sort of movie. So hopefully it's on at a time that they can actually make it. And, I mean, it is a short film. That's another thing, actually. It is 40 minutes shorter than Ikkadu, which I thought was going to be a problem, but it's not, and it actually keeps the structure of Ikkadu. There's a very interesting story shift, and I was very surprised to find out that they were able to keep that in this film as well. So even though this one is considerably shorter than the original, it doesn't suffer for that, which is, I think, another really impressive thing about the film.
I mean, it's a lean film, isn't it?
It's as lean as Mr. Nighy, and it's as gorgeous to look at.
And I hope this does get a bit of play in UK cinemas, because if we're not going to show it, who is?
Absolutely, it really is, isn't it? It's like, guys, just hope, yeah, that the biggest chain Odeon gives it a fair shake. Yeah, so I think the only thing I've got to say is, I don't know that much about Ishiguro. I have read The Remains of the Day, and I've read Never Let Me Go. They're the only two of his books that I've read. Everything that he's done, though, has had a massive emotional impact on me. So The Remains of the Day, when I first saw that, that just... rip my heart out. I had no idea what the story was going to be. I saw the film before I read the book. And that just ripped my heart out. And then I saw Never Let Me Go again before I read the book. You can spot a pattern. And what was happening to the characters in Never Let Me Go, even though you don't see it, the films are 12. What's happening to them I found so disturbing that I actually... almost blacked out in the cinema and had to get up and leave. And it's when friend of the podcast, Adrian Zach, hello Adrian, took me to a BAFTA screening of it. And we were in the middle and I just had to get up and barge by all these people because I literally couldn't see because my eyes were blacking out because I was having a bit of a panic attack about this film. And then this one, I was left really, really moist-eyed at the end of this one as well. It's like, Ishiguro, you really understand how to pull my heartstrings.
Yeah, I say, I don't think I've... The closest I came is I think I had a panic attack during 40 Days of Night, but I don't think that was related to the film. I think that's just...
Why was that?
I don't know. It's like, this is a very middle-of-the-road film. I'm assuming there are other factors at play here than just this film that's, like, a bit intense.
Did you realise there was an essay that was overdue or something?
I'm not wearing any clothes.
And I haven't got a pen. Can anyone lend me a pen? I need to do the exam. But with Never Let Me Go, when I spilt out of the screening room and was standing there at the top of the stairs, and there was a staff member who kind of said, "Are you okay?" And it's like, that film's really got under my skin. I just, oh my God. But as soon as I got out, yeah, my head cleared and my vision came back and she got me a glass of water, bless her heart. And then I went back in to watch it because I'd Never Let Me Go is absolutely brilliant and that was my film of the year. Actually, also reading the book, because I read the book afterwards, there's a passage in it about a character playing with a doll that is so moving that actually it's one of the few books that actually made me well up. Yeah, I should read more of his books. I've had The Buried Giant on my shelf for about 10 years and haven't looked at it. So I would probably have to read that one.
Yeah, as I said, I think, you know, anything by Kazuo Ishiguro. I keep on inverting Ishiguro Kazuro. I'm trying to think what else he's written. I mean, obviously, it's Never Let Me Go. It's Remains of the Day, Buried Giant. Oh, The Unconsoled.
Oh, okay. Is that good?
The Unconsoled. Yeah, I think I read that when I was at uni. But yeah, I think the first I ever read was Remains of the Day, and I think I read that immediately after seeing the film, which, as you say, seems to be the...
Well, these films are really, really good adaptations of his books. I mean, yeah, The Remains of the Day and Never Let Me Go are first-class movies. They're both five-star movies. This is a five-star movie as well. Yes, and also for those people saying, why are they saying the names the wrong way round? We're saying it the Japanese way of the family name first.
Because Rob's actually been to do and lived in Japan. I'm just following suit.
Yes, indeed. Well, I just think it's one of those things. It's like, well, we do it for everyone else. We do it for the Chinese directors. We do it for the South Korean directors. It's just that because Japanese cinema came along and was popular much earlier, it got westernized. But the family name is very, very important in Japan as much as it is in the other Asian countries. So it's like, we should be saying family name first. I mean, I'm kind of assuming here that Ishiguro Kazuo also refers to himself in that way. Because he's lived in England so long, he might actually just switch it around now. But I don't know, but I'm just going with, well, the fact that's a very, very Japanese name, I'll say it in a very, very Japanese way.
So Mr. Ishiguro, or Kazuo, if you're listening to this, please let us know.
Or Ishiguro-sensei.
Ishiguro-sensei, yes. Please let us know what you're preferred.
And then come on to have a chat, that'd be great. Could you imagine that?
You've completely misunderstood my work.
Yes. The whole thing's an action film. It's all comedy action. I do buddy movies.
It is. What? My God, it is Taken.
And Seven and Saw.
Lucked into that one.
Accidentally stumbled into that one. As blind as I was when I was leaving the cinema during Never Let Me Go. Have you ever blacked out?
Yeah.
It's weird, isn't it? Because, well, I don't know about you. I didn't black out. I just lost my vision. It just greyed over. And then I suddenly realised my eyes were wide open and I couldn't see anything. But I was aware I could hear things. Everything just seemed as if I was listening to it down a hall and I could feel things. I just couldn't see anything. It was so weird. It was like, look, you are having a panic attack. This is not real. It's a film. Breathe in and breathe out. That's not working. It's only getting worse. Oh my God, I can't see anything.
Breathe in, breathe out. Faster, right? Just need to keep the faster I breathe, the...
That's right. It's not working. Two in and one out. That might work.
Or maybe one in and two out.
That's not working either. But did the same thing happen to you? Were you kind of like removed of vision but kind of aware of everything else?
Well, yeah, I mean, for me, when it happened, I basically managed to kind of get into a semi-crouching position so that when I kind of hit the deck, I wasn't going to be falling from my height.
And this was during 40 Days of Night?
No, this was another occasion.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I didn't full-on pass out during 40 Days of Night. That was more, as you say, my vision got swimmy and my chest got tight, and I was like, I think I'd better just not be in here for a little bit.
Well, actually, that's exactly what the children in the audience. When I saw that film, I was in New York, and there were kids that were just taken in to watch that film. As you said, an intense film. I mean, some of it's really quite scary. And these kids were freaking out. And it's like, why are they in here? It's obviously not suitable. So the kids were crying and they were taken out. And it's like, thank God. So these kids were taken out. 15 minutes later, they were brought back in again. and then they had to be taken out again because, like, this is not going to stop being a horror film. This is a horror film. And I would imagine the further we get into the plot, the more spectacularly horrific it's going to be. That was an interesting experience because these kids were just constantly taken in and out during this film because they just kept screaming and crying, which was like, oh, a singular experience. Well, we shall go into your second attack, just in case it's something that you don't want to talk about. So is there anything else to say about Living? And what a journey this has been.
Living. It's a really lovely film with a number of tremendous performances, particularly by Bill Nighy.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you get a chance, please go and see it in the cinema, because that's how we get more films like this.
Absolutely. Well, that seems like quite a nice place to end it then.
Yes, well, Mr. Daniel, thank you so much. And if our listeners would like to find you online, where can they do so?
Well, if you want to find me on Twitter, that's a thing we need to talk about, isn't it? Are we going to stay on Twitter? We are on Twitter at the moment. And you can find me at rob_a_Daniel. Then again, I was reading that Elon Musk is going to shadow ban or shadow suppress anyone tweeting from an unchecked account. So unless you pay for the blue tick, your stuff is going to be pushed down in the algorithms, even amongst your friends. So who knows if Twitter's even going to be worth using going forwards. But anyway, but for the moment, I'm on Twitter, and that's where you can find me. You can also find my writing at electric-shadows.com. And if you love that film Highlander, another amazing film about someone trying to get the most out of life, even though, ironically, compared to Living, they have a lot of life to live, and you want to know more about the film Highlander, then why not listen to a scene-by-scene breakdown podcast about it?
Well, of course, you know, Highlander does have the line in it, most people are afraid to die, you're afraid to live.
Yes, that's right. And that fits in really, really well with Living. So yeah, if you want to listen to a podcast that goes through Highlander scene-by-scene, then I'd recommend Another Time MacLeod, which is a podcast that Rob and I do. And yeah, we are at the end, aren't we? We're going to be recording the final episode today of the actual film breakdown. Then after that, we'll be going into other things Highlander related. But yeah, that's a journey that we are on, and we are at the end of a major part of it.
Yes, at least in this iteration, yeah. It's one of the wonderful things about the Movie Robcast is that, you know, there will always be new movies to review. And if there aren't new movies to review, we'll review old movies. But with Highlander, at least in terms of the film's runtime, it's a finite thing. We've reached the end of the duration, and now we'll be figuring out what a future iteration might look like.
That's right. So yeah, if you want to listen to that, that is available wherever you're listening to this. You can follow that on Twitter at MacLeod Time. And if you want to drop us an email that's about Highlander, you can do so at whowantstopodforever@gmail.com.
Great. And well, yeah, if you're looking for me online, you can find me on Twitter for the moment at Robert M. Wallace. You can also find my writing, such as it is, at Of All The Film Sites, www.ofallthefilmsites.com. And you can follow this podcast, the one that you're currently listening to, on Twitter, again, for the moment, at Movie Robcast. You can also drop us an email at movierobcast@gmail.com. And if you have enjoyed this, please do rate and review. It's lovely to have the feedback, and it really does make the difference, helping this podcast reach a wider audience. And Mr. Daniel, thank you again.
Thank you. I'm actually just looking at your website. I haven't looked at it for a couple of weeks. You've got a review of Black Adam. I'm going to read that. Sorry, I just thought I'd interject with that at the end.
I was able to get that written up fairly quickly because I had some things to say about it. Obviously, we are, my main takeaway, of course, being continuing to push Pierce Brosnan to be Ramirez in the Highlander remake.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's a very good point. Always a pleasure to be here. And as Rob said, thanks all for listening.
Thank you very much for listening. And we'll be with you again very soon.
Bravo, Miss Harris.
No, I remember what it's like to be alive.